Hey, this is Dane from Osaka Punch, and you're listening to the 9-8 podcast. If you only catch half of this podcast, it'll be the 9-16 podcast. And if you only catch a quarter of it, it'll be 9-32. Enjoy.
Every fortnight, as these are now fortnightly episodes, is the wonderful, majestic, fantastic Mr. Alex Hogg.
Ah, oh, Dave, you flatter too much.
I try. Welcome back, as I said, ladies and gentlemen, everyone. And thanks for joining us again for another fortnight of talking about prog and everything around it. Oggie, how are you?
I'm good. It's been a really, really nice day here in Perth, finally, after a week of miserable, pissy, rainy weather.
You've had the miserable, pissy weather as well? Because we've had it for about 5 or 6 days straight, just rain and just...
Oh, lovely. That's what you want.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But hey, it could be worse. Friday night was interesting because it was pouring rain. And I actually went out to see the guys at Osaka Punch play with Mammal. And I'll get onto that a little bit later on in the show. Hoggy, what are we talking about in primary this week? I think we're continuing our Around the World in 80 Minutes or one prog song.
Yes, we are. But first, we have follow-up. And follow-up, I'm going to put a link in the show notes to an episode of the Sure Signal Path podcast. This one is with Steve Hogarth, the frontman for Marillion. And principally, this one he's talking about something that we briefly covered in our Marillion Extravaganza episode back in our second ever episode. And he's talking about the Marillion Tour Fund, how the American fans got together and got a bunch of money together on the internet and gave it to the band and said, you know, we want you to come to tour America. Mm-hmm. So we'll put that link. It's a very interesting story.
Yeah.
The precursor to the precursor of the crowdfunding.
Yeah, absolutely. And you were talking about that as well. I remember from our Marillion Extravaganza episode, as you so aptly put it. and it is great to see that the people are doing that and they're happy to fund that. It'd be nice, actually, if there was a little bit more of that these days. And I think there is a little bit more of that going on in some of the Latin American countries, which we probably will get to talk about a little bit later on.
Marillion, every now and then people ask Marillion, oh, let's do another tour fund. And the band's management have had to clamp down on that and say, actually, no, we can't do that anymore because it runs into problems with visas into America.
Does it really?
Yeah, apparently it does. The details are a bit sketchy, but that's apparently the story. It's that can't do it anymore, causes problems with visas.
Bit irritating, isn't it? Because I know in Australia, a lot of bands don't elect to come here on, you know, I'm in a band and I'm touring the music sort of thing. They come on holiday visas. And I've got a
friend. And unless you know Peter Dutton, you don't get in. Hi-yo!
The inbred potato. Got to go easy on him every now and then.
Oh, goodness.
The wrong podcast. I know a lot of guys who do tour management for bands and so on and so forth that come across from, you know, the States or Europe or even some of the guys that come over from the Philippines and so on and so forth. And more often than not, they just pull them in on tourist visas and just say, oh, yeah, we're just here for a couple of weeks, just, you know, being tourists. And then when they get here, they just hire gear when they get here. And especially now with the advent of a lot of digital signal processing stuff, like, you know, AXFXs and Kempers and all that sort of stuff, you don't need to lug massive amplifiers and all that sort of stuff across anymore. So
Or even a pedal board. I've seen loads of shows where the guys are just running their guitar rigs out of a laptop. Everything's all in there, and I think they've just got the program change button where they just push a button and switches whatever, and off they go.
Exactly, and most of that stuff is hired. So, you know, they don't
Well,
really
maybe the laptop is theirs. The laptop's theirs, but the buttons are
all... Yes, yes. Yeah. But all the heavy stuff is all hired here within the borders of the country. And actually, a friend of mine... who, as I said, he does some, he often has bands staying at his place and so on and so forth because he's often got bands over from overseas. And he had an incident at the airport where some guys got caught and they caught them with a bag full of their tour merch.
Oh, dear. Yeah, it's not very clever.
And the guys were like, oh, you know, we didn't want to sort of get it done in Australia because it costs us like three times as much to make a shirt. So from now on, basically, he's just said, look, we can't let people come in with tour merch. You have to either buy it here or get it shipped to here. We can't, we just can't do that. And now it's an additional cost that they have, unfortunately. But still kind of a funny story. The way he tells it is much better than the way that I'm telling it, because I'm terrible at telling these stories secondhand. So.
No, you've reminded me of a story. I remember listening to an interview with Gavin Harrison. I'll see if I can find it, but he was talking about when Porcupine Tree went on tour and they go through America, they would, like when they crossed into Canada, apparently you need to pay the tax on any merchandise you're bringing into the country.
That's correct, yeah.
So what they would do is they would hire a cheap hotel room somewhere near the border, stuff all the merchandise in there they don't need, take only what they were going to sell across the border, sell it and come back. They'd stop in on the hotel room on the way back and pick up all the stuff.
When there's a will, there's a way, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I'm sure he's not the only one who's done it. I'm sure there's loads of bands out there who'd be like, well, we're going to get around this tax problem by
you
just
can bet on
only
it.
Coming across the border with like 50 T-shirts and that's it.
And we will actually be talking a little bit about Gavin Harrison a little later in the podcast as well.
Talking about Pineapple Thief record.
Exactly, the new Pineapple Thief record, which did drop, was it last week I think it dropped?
Last week. Yep.
Yeah, and precursor to that, it is fantastic. We should move on. You've got a note here, Anekdoten, Swedish progressive rock. Tell us about that.
This is a band that was recommended to me by my fiance, who seems to know all the great music these days. We just sort of bumble around and talk rubbish on the internet and continually make jokes about the wrong podcast. So these guys are a Swedish progressive rock band in the similar sort of vein to modern-day Opeth, I would say. You know, a lot of looking back, you know, taking old sounds and re-recording them in a modern way and sort of a bit of a modern twist on it. Did you get a chance to listen to this, Dave?
I didn't, unfortunately. I've been running around the last week. Actually, my girlfriend had wisdom teeth out a few days ago, and I've sort of been playing carer for her for the last couple of days. So I haven't had much of a chance to do a lot, really. And when you have someone who's doped up on all kinds of great painkillers.
All that great stuff.
The last thing I sort of want to listen to is, you know, prog rock and particularly heavy stuff. So I've seen...
This stuff's quite light, actually. This is the more modern day Opeth stuff. This is quite light. A lot of organs and mellotrons and acoustic guitars and that sort of thing.
Okay, interesting.
Give it a listen. We'll get your take on that one next time around.
Absolutely. A slight anecdote to that. On Friday night, I went and saw Osaka Punch play. My housemate was kind enough to offer to look after my girlfriend for a couple of hours while I went and did my photography thing and then went and spoke to the guys. And you guys will hear that interview a little bit later on, my interview with Dane from Osaka Punch a little bit later on in the episode. And I got speaking to one of the support acts who was Fresh Violet. Now, Fresh Violet is a hip-hop artist from Melbourne supporting, and she was doing the tour with Mammal and Osaka Punch, which is, I thought, a bit of an odd thing to have a hip-hop artist play a sort of heavy rock, heavy metal, prog metal gig. But, hey, each to their own. Really interesting stuff, by the way. If you're into hip-hop and you like sort of branching out, listening to different music, go check it out. But we got talking afterwards, and we were actually talking about OPEF and all that, about whether or not we like the old stuff or the new stuff. And she's more a fan of the older pre-Watershed stuff, and so on and so forth, which I thought was really interesting. But the thing that I thought was really interesting was a conversation that we had. When she was on stage, I was in the pit doing the photography thing, and there were a couple of other photographers there. They were sort of wondering how old she was. You know, and this is the inherent sexism in the industry. And I'll put my hand up and say she wasn't particularly hard to look at. And she's obviously a very fantastic person as well. But they're all, you know, having a yak and saying, oh, you know, how old is she? I think she's 23, 24, da-da-da. And I'm sitting there thinking, nah, I reckon she's older than that. She's got to be 28, 29. So afterwards, I actually asked her, and I explained the situation to her and said, look, some of the guys in the pit were wondering how old you were. Can I ask you without getting a slap? And she said, look, I'll tell you I'm within this age range, and I won't tell you the age range because she asked me not to tell anyone. And she said, but I'm not going to give you my exact age because the industry is really sexist and it is really ageist, especially towards women. So in the interest of protecting my art and protecting my income and protecting my livelihood, I'm not going to tell you. And I thought, okay, A, good on you for doing that. That's awesome for being that dedicated that you're not doing that. But secondly, how fortunate is that that you can't answer a simple question? How old are you? You know,
this is 2018, for fuck's sake. You know, what is this, 1973?
Exactly.
Well, and interesting. I've got a similar story to this, not with women, though, but with a man. Steve Hogarth, there's a bit of conjecture in amongst the fan base of how old he actually is. I'm going to blow the lid off it now. He's actually 60. But if you look on his Wikipedia page, it says he's 58. And everybody, oh, why is that? Why is that? Well, it turns out sometime during the early 90s, the band's manager rang him up, and I think he was in his early 30s at that point. And the band's manager at the time, John Arneson, rang Steve up and said, hey, Steve, how do you feel like being 30 again? And Steve sort of said, oh, who wouldn't want to be 30 again? And I was like, oh, okay, great. Puts the phone down. And I think they'd gone around and like changed all the records on the internet or, you know, in and around the place to backdate his birthday a couple of years.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. And is that an ageism thing within the industry? Is that the reason they did that, or?
Pretty much. And even now, there are some fans who will still argue mercilessly to say that he is, he's not 60. But I happen to know a few people who are friends with some of his family on the internet, and they saw photos of his 60th birthday party on the internet.
There you go.
So, yeah, if you look at it on his Facebook page, it says that he was born in 1959. He's not. He's born in 1960. He's born in 1957.
There you go. So people adjusting their age because of...
Well, band's management adjusting their age.
Yeah.
The management adjusting their age to suit some sort of, I don't know, bullshit.
Depressing. Absolutely depressing.
Yeah.
We digressed a bit. But from
yes, we
one...
did.
One person to another old rocker, I suppose, Peter Frampton. You've got a note here. It's actually a photograph of a tweet by Peter Frampton for 55 million streams, I'm guessing on one of our favourite streaming services, of Baby, I Love Your Way. Now, everybody knows that song. I'm going to play a little snippet of here just to remind people what it sounds like. So 55 million streams of Baby, I Love Your Way netted $1,700.
That's bullshit.
It's just terrible, isn't it?
It harks back to the quote that I made from Pharrell Williams' song, Happy. Now he got, you know, however many hundreds of millions of streams that was and netted $3,000. It just shows how that model is so fundamentally broken at the moment, and they really need to do something to make it better for artists. Otherwise, you're just going to... We discussed this before in our episode about Spotify, that you'll end up in a situation where people are going to be unable to afford to make music.
That's right.
And that leads to all sorts of problems with the art form, where you have basically rich people making music because they're the only ones that can afford to do it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's disgusting. In my opinion. But we should probably move on to the news, unless you've got any more follow-up for today.
No, that was it. So, right. The news. Devin Townsend has written a book.
Is it just a list of all of his strange and wacky tunings that he uses? Or
No. He's written a book. The title of the book is called How to Develop Creativity and Excel as a Successful Independent Songwriter in a Changing Industry. Yeah.
That actually sounds really interesting.
Oh, yeah. And
especially from someone like Devin, who, let's face it, is not, I mean, nowhere near mainstream.
Oh, God. He's been very open.
And he's quite successful as well.
He's been very successful, but he's also very open about how much money he makes. He was quoted in an interview that I think it was 2016. I'll see if I can find the article for the show notes. He made $60,000 one year after paying the band, touring, people, agents, promoters, blah, 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 all that. $60,000 he made by touring all around the world for about 10 months.
Yeah. Still, so I mean, if I could make 60 grand to do that, or 60 grand doing what I'm currently doing, I think I would probably rather do what he's doing.
But
I don't enjoy my job. But, you know, I mean, come on, I'm a muso at heart, like, far out.
Yep.
But that being said, I mean, it really does seem to me that the days of making millions from touring, like, you know, a la Metallica and Michael Jackson and all those guys, really gone.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's gone completely. Unless you are a really big name, unless you're the Rolling Stones or Paul McCartney or whoever, or Phil Collins, who could charge $250 for a goddamn ticket to one of his concerts, thank you very kindly, then maybe you can make loads of money.
The Sydney tour of that, by the way, sold out.
The first show in Perth sold out. They've added a second one.
Yeah, I know. Of course, they always do that. I don't know if they do that where you guys live, listeners, but here in Australia, what a lot of promotion companies do is they book 5 shows, for example, in each of the capital cities in Australia. And by each of the capital cities, I mean Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, and Perth. They're generally the 5.
Sometimes even Adelaide don't even get in, unless they're really big, unless it's like, you know, Phil Collins or the Stones. Adelaide don't even get a look in most of the time.
Exactly. Sometimes even they skip straight over Adelaide, and a lot of them now are starting to skip Perth as well. But more often than not, what they do is they book one night in, for example, Perth, and then they leave 2 nights, and then they book a night in Adelaide, and then they leave 2 nights, and they book a night in Melbourne, and they leave 2 nights, so that when the first show sells out, what they can do is they can just easily book another night. And everybody knows they do it, and yet every single time people just buy the tickets to the first night instead of just waiting for the second night, which is just ridiculous. But the prices in Sydney were obscene. I think the first 3 or 4 rows or something like that were like $1,100 a ticket.
Yeah, it was $1,000 for the first. You get, but for that you get like a 3-course dinner. A 3-course dinner, I should point out, that has that is A, not with Phil Collins, and B, not personally prepared by Phil Collins. So what the f*** are you paying $1,000 for? Yeah, I'm pretty sure there'd be places like you could go to like Chelsea or Knightsbridge in London and pay less than that.
Yeah, absolutely. You could go to Gordon Ramsay's restaurant and have him stand at the table and abuse you for less than that. I mean, seriously. But obscene. Yep. Absolutely obscene. Another slight little bit of news that I do want to cover off on as well. The world's highest selling album changed hands recently. I was going to mention this last time on the podcast, but unfortunately I forgot. It used to be Michael Jackson's Thriller. That was the number one selling album of all time. It's recently changed now to The Greatest Hits by the Eagles.
Really? Which one? Isn't there like 7 or 8 of them?
No, The Greatest Hits by the Eagles. The one with the skull on the front.
Oh, okay, that one. Sorry, yeah. I thought Greatest Hits albums by the Eagles were like Greatest Hits tours by the Eagles, that they just keep going and going and going and going.
Like John Farnham's No Seriously, This Is Seriously The Last Time, This Time Please Come and Give Me Some Money Because It Is The Last Time.
Yes, one of those tours. No, really, This Is The Last One tour. Not like those other three.
Boy That Cried Wolf.
The Boy That Cried Tour. Called, did,
didn't the Eagles, was it the Eagles that did a tour called Not In This Lifetime or When Hell Freezes Over or something?
Yes, it was. It was the Eagles. They did the Hell Freezes Over tour. And that was, it was actually from a quote from a press conference they gave when they broke up. And I can't remember who it was. I think it was Joe Walsh.
Don Henley, was it?
So Don Henley said, you guys ever going to get back together? And he said, yeah, when Hell Freezes Over. So then when they did the tour and they decided to get back together because, you know, they were running out of money or something, they decided to call it Hell Freezes Over World Tour. Fun fact, my dad actually went to that here in Australia when they did the tour. And then later on when they came out for their Farewell One, literally, it was called Farewell One.
I remember that. It was, yeah. We always used to, my parents and I used to refer to those tours as the superannuation tour. Just putting the money away in the super that they could retire.
So
I was like, oh boy, John Farnham's out. His superannuation must run dry again.
No, I agree. It is interesting how you're getting a lot of these old rockers now who are starting to come back. And who was it recently I saw? There was someone who'd announced a tour and I went, how are you still relevant? Like what existence do you think that I give a flying fuck about your music now? It was someone like Simple Plan or Fallout Boy or one of those guys who, let's be honest, when I was 14 or 13 or something like that, I would have been there in a heartbeat, no problems, right? In actual fact, I think I did see Simple Plan from memory.
Yeah, did they play Big Day Out one? I know they played Big Day Out, and then they got bottled off stage. Somebody booed, and they all got bottled.
No, that was My Chemical Romance, I think.
Was it? I thought it was Simple Plan.
It could have been both. I don't know.
Yeah, it could have been. Or maybe My Chemical Romance got bottled in Sydney, and then they decided to bottle Simple Plan in Perth or something.
Well, let's just hope. We can live in hope, right?
Look at us respecting the art form of an emo band.
I don't know if you remember it. There was a viral video a little while ago, a viral song. This is going back to the days of like E-Bomb's World and, you know, all that sort of stuff, which for those of you who don't know what that is listening to the podcast, it was an old video site back before the days of YouTube and all that sort of stuff where people would make flash videos, like animated made in a program called Flash, which was by Adobe, videos with music and shit on it. And there was this one song, and it was called I'm an Emo Kid. And I think from memory the lyrics...
Oh, I remember that one.
Yeah. And the lyrics
I saw the Flash video, but I remember listening to the song.
Yeah, because there was a Flash video that went along with it, and I couldn't tell you what it was now. But it went, I'm an emo kid, non-conforming as can be, because you'd be non-conforming too if you look just like me.
It was so funny.
And it was just
talking
a piss
take about
on.
Him reading the, what's it? It was like read the Catcher in the Rye and Watch Me Jack Off or something. I think was one of the lines of the song. I don't think I ever saw the video, but I sure as hell remember the song.
It was pretty funny. Yep. So we're digressing a little bit from the news. Another thing you've got written down here is Toto, who have announced they're playing Falls Festival.
We were talking about festivals, and I saw the internet collectively explode. It's like, oh my god, Toto, we're coming to play! Yay! And I sort of felt that like Toto was sort of becoming a bit like what Oasis was sort of 15 years ago.
Yeah, so anyway...
They're known for one song.
So anyway, here's Africa.
Pretty much. You know. And let's be honest, of all the songs that Toto have written, Africa is probably not... Well, at least for me anyway, probably not even top 10. They have written a lot better songs than that.
Oh, absolutely. But, I mean, Africa is an anthem. No matter which way you slice it, it seems to be covered by
absolutely fucking everybody.
Well, now it became a meme. My girlfriend and I were talking about it the other day, and I went to her, how did it explode? And she said, because it became a meme. I was like, really? She said, yeah, it became a meme. Like, and she explained it all to me, and I can't remember
like
exactly
a Rick
the
Astley
explanation.
Type thing, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, that was the comparison she used. She said, you know, like that whole, you know, Rick Rolling thing. It was kind of the same with that. I was like, really? Because for me, I just always knew the song and I always loved the song. So when it became popular again, I was just like, oh, okay, it's popular again. Yay. You know, have you heard this new song? And I suppose that's kind of one of the sad things is a lot of this old music. I say old music, but music that's not, you know, post 2000s, post 2010s. is now becoming popular again, which is great, but it's also really annoying when you hear people saying things like, oh, have you heard the song by Toto, you know, Africa? And it's like, yeah, I was listening to that when I was like four.
Yeah, I was like, going to say, the song in itself was recorded in 1982.
Yes.
So it's 36 years old.
It's just incredible. But I mean, you're right, they do have some other great songs. I mean, Hold the Line is a brilliant, brilliant song.
Rosanna,
yeah. I'll Supply the Love. Yeah, there's some great, great songs in their repertoire. It's just,
and yet all we're going to get is they're at this festival, they're going to play Africa probably at the end of the set, and we're just going to end up with a bunch of dickheads just bellowing out Africa. Sort of like how, yep, Daryl Braithwaite has become just a really bad joke because of that song Horses.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is not even his. It's not even his, yeah, song.
it's emerging a cover. Artists YouTube video ads now completely going away from all that sort of stuff, but kind of saying in the same internet vibe. Something really cool's come up. Now, Australian musicians have started paying to replace YouTube video ads with emerging artists. So instead of having, you know, the ads for QBE Insurance or some, you know, burger joint, KFC or Burger King or Hungry Jack's or whatever it is in this country, they're actually starting
Burger King, where you are, Hungry Jack's where I am, isn't it? Isn't that how that works?
No, it's Hungry Jack's in Australia because Burger King was already taken by some burger shop in Adelaide, so they had to change it to something else.
Yeah, they had to give a different name, and then that Burger King went bust and never bothered to change the name.
That's right. So 5 Seconds of Summer, Alice in Wonderland, The Rubens, and 360, don't know who the last one is, have teamed up for the new Extra Support Act program, giving up ads before their music videos to emerging artists as a kind of digital support act, which I think is actually a great idea.
Great idea for the art. However, is it actually going to result in ad? Well, I suppose because YouTube AdSense money for them is probably just hilariously low anyway. Who cares? Mm-hmm. They're not exactly even factoring that into their percentages of, you know, sort of profit for the band.
Yeah, exactly.
They're just like, let's do something with it.
Mm, exactly. So I think that's a bit of positive news that's come across in the last couple of weeks. And one other piece of news from the Dream Theater Camp, because this wouldn't be one of our podcasts without something from the Dream Theater Camp. Mm-hmm. There was a tweet this morning from James LaBrie.
Yep. He is in the studio recording vocals. Woo! It was a video put out by the band not that long ago, a couple of days ago, that Jordan had finished keyboards. The keyboards are done. The video showed some little snippets of him playing, well, I assume tracking keyboards and stuff from the new album. Sounds good. Sounds like, you know, a return to more sort of quote-unquote traditional Dream Theater as opposed to the Astonishing.
Yeah, yeah. And that's good. Anything that's not the Astonishing will be good. but no, brilliant. I think it's from the snippets that we're hearing, it sounds amazing. We're just kind of hoping that it stays that way. So the only other bit of news I suppose we really need to talk about is something that we can probably move on actually to our next subject, which is the new Pineapple Thief record, which was released start of last week, I believe. Yep. Now, I'm assuming you've listened to it because I wouldn't imagine something being released by Gavin Harrison would get too long in the tooth before it managed to grace your tape decks over there, Poggy.
Yep. So the new album is called Dissolution. It was released at the end of August, 31st of August, so a couple of weeks later on as we're recording. This record is phenomenal. Bruce Sword, who does vocals and guitars for Pineapple Thief, is an amazing singer, amazing songwriter. And Gavin Harrison plays drums on this record. We'll throw a link in the show notes. He's done a drum track video to this to one of the songs on this record.
So just so the listeners understand the majesty that is this brilliant album, with all of the intricate pieces that fall into a Pineapple Thief album. I'm just going to play a really quick little bit from one of the songs, which is called Far Below. So I'm just going to play 30 seconds of this so you can hear what we're talking about, and we'll be back in a sec. So that was a little excerpt from the Pineapple Thief, Far Below, from their new album, Disillusion. I have to say this whole album is incredible, amazing, and it's enough. What I like about this album is that it is enough like Porcupine Tree to make it nice, but not enough like Porcupine Tree to make me really annoyed that it's not Porcupine Tree.
Yeah, I was just going to say exact same thing, that it sounds like Porcupine Tree, but doesn't sound so much like Porcupine Tree to make it sound like a complete ripoff. Now, I'm led to believe that Gavin Harrison did have at least some input in writing this record, that it's completely all Bruce Sword. Okay. I'm happy to take my beating on the internet later if it turns out I'm wrong, but as is usually the way with these things. So if that's the case, then that sound...
I haven't read anything about it, about the new album. Like, I haven't even looked at this one on Wikipedia, so I don't know who's written what, but all I can tell you is that it is a absolutely brilliant album.
Yeah, because the version that I have is a digital copy. I haven't ordered a CD because it'll take 3 weeks to get here. Mm-hmm. I don't have any particular... extra information on who wrote what, but I'm led to believe that Bruce wrote pretty much all of it. I've got an interview here on K-Scope Music, the record label that put this album out. I'm going to quote directly here. It's been a real collaborative journey between the four of us writing and recording this record, with each song taking on a life of its own. When everyone pulls in the same direction, amazing things can happen. The Pineapple Thief is a different proposition with Gavin. The time he was with me from the inception of Disillusion, and together we took the songs into territory that I wouldn't have found on my own. So it certainly sounds like he is at least involved in the writing of the record.
I hope so, because Gavin Harrison is an absolute weapon, A, of a drummer, and B, of a songwriter. So,
oh, absolutely. All of the reinterpretation of the King Crimson material that is being done now with the band, most of that comes from, or Gavin certainly has a big hand in that. So, you know, reinterpreting stuff like, you know, the construction of light for three drums instead of two. And, you know, the reinterpretation of that, it is amazing. He is a phenomenal musician.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, he works on, I don't know if you've heard the early Porcupine Tree stuff, when they got Gavin to join the band, or when Gavin joined the band, he went back and re-recorded some of the stuff on...
Yes, I have those, actually. I have copies of those albums, the remasters and that. And they took, with, I mean, the first Gavin record... Yeah, the first record, I think, yes. The first record, I'm pretty sure, was done with a drum machine. There wasn't actually a drum. Well, the first, what was it? The first two or three records of Porcupine Tree was just Stephen Wilson in his bed, and sort of in his bedroom. So I think it wasn't actually a band.
That's right.
And then I think it was with The Sky Moves Sideways, he actually put together an actual band. And that was with Gavin Chris Maitland on drums. And then he left. Don't know where he went or what happened there, but he left. And then Gavin came in. Yeah, they re-recorded a bunch of and it gets, it's definitely changes it. It changes it when you've got drummer as opposed to drum machine.
Yeah, absolutely. And
even though Radioactive Toy is still one of my favorite Porcupine Tree songs.
Yeah, absolutely, and it changes between drummers as well. I mean, I said this a while ago, but having seen Portnoy's Shattered Fortress, and having seen Dream Theater a few times as well, I realized after seeing the Shattered Fortress how much I missed Portnoy being in the band and being behind the kit, because the way that he plays And I'm not saying that Mangini can't pull his parts off perfectly, because he can.
They wouldn't have hired him if he couldn't.
Well, exactly. And he can play them note for note perfectly. But there's just something that the way Portnoy does things behind the kit as a personality. And you can feel that in the drum stuff that he does. And you know what? It's the same with Gavin Harrison. You hear his takes on particular things and some of the little fills and things he does. Like The Sound of Music, right? That song is unbelievable. That opening drum riff is just so good. Just incredible. So for the Pineapple Thief to have such a phenomenal drummer playing with them, I think is just absolutely brilliant. And it really does help lift the entire album up as well. Even in the parts where it's just simple 4-4 stuff and they're playing and Gavin's just doing these weird accents on things and you're going, why? Like, I understand why you're doing this because it sounds awesome. I don't know how you're doing it and how you're even coming up with that stuff, but it's incredible. Pineapple Thief Disillusion is out now. You can listen to it on all streaming sites and so on. I don't know if you can buy it in...
Oh, shit, yeah. I bought it.
In shops like JB Hi-Fi.
Oh, in an actual, like, music store, walk in and buy it off the shelf? Probably not. Yeah,
probably not in Australia, maybe in other countries.
I mean, this is just a personal preference. I've given up going to music stores to try and find stuff.
Yeah,
unless it's something huge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I will just buy it off the internet.
Yeah, I know.
And I dare say there's a lot of people out there, a lot of music fans out there who do the same thing.
Absolutely.
Just don't bother with going into music stores anymore because there's a whole bunch of it's just fucking shit in there. You know?
So yeah, but new Pineapple Thief album, two thumbs up from me.
Oh, absolutely. I think
definitely brilliant.
Unless something major happens, this will probably end up on the top of my 2018 album list.
And I guess this is a perfect time to go across into our main event. Talking about our main event for the day, which is South American prog bands and metal scene and so on and so forth.
And we have to start with Sepultura. I think that's where it all sort of kicks off from there. That mix of traditional Brazilian rhythms and instrumentation, that sort of stuff, with metal, I think that you have to start there. You can't go anywhere else from there.
Absolutely.
Obviously, Sepultura now, the Cavaldera brothers are both out of the band for various reasons. So they're obviously a very different band than they were at the height of their fame in probably the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still going around. They put out an album last year, which is pretty good. Pretty good. You know, a lot of... so...
Yeah, I mean, that... That album, which I think was that Machine Messiah?
Yep.
That was a brilliant album. And I've got to admit, I'm not the biggest Sepultura fan.
Me either, to be honest.
But it was a great album. And the amount of times that, you know, mates of mine would have it on if we were in the car and so on and so forth, and I'd be like, oh, that's good. Like, it's tasty, you know? It's not, it's not exactly what I would listen to, but I wouldn't turn it off. Which is,
yeah, exactly.
You know, brilliant. But I know that their early influences were obviously heavy metal, hard rock groups, you know, which back in the 80s, to have those sorts of influences where you're the likes of Kiss, Black Sabbath, Iron Maiden, Motorhead, Whitesnake, you know, Metallica probably a little bit later as well, Slayer, Testament, da-da-da, all those sorts of dudes. But their... other stuff that they sort of, the way that they actually implemented and integrated a lot of their Latin roots as well, as you mentioned, with the Latin beats and so on and so forth, was mind-bendingly good at the time. And these guys were some of the big influences for the later stuff that bands like Korn would do, where they had a lot of Latin beats and a lot of stuff jumping in there as well. And even some of the stuff that guys like Primus would take it and run with it as far as they humanly could. And even though Primus isn't a particularly heavy band, they're very, very heavily influenced by a lot of that offbeat.
A lot of funk stuff. Definitely a funk thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, you've heard the story about Les Claypool when he auditioned for Metallica, right?
No.
So when Cliff Burton died in 1986, see, Les Claypool and Kirk Hammett went to school together. Kirk Hammett appeared in a Primus video. Yeah. And so Kirk said to Les, you know, come down and audition. And Les Claypool walked in and Lars made something. He was like, oh, you know, you're not probably familiar with metal music, are you? And Les said something along the lines of, oh, yeah, you know, you want to jam on some Isley Brothers tunes? And nobody got the joke. Les Claypool then proceeded to play Master of Puppets entirely on the bass. he didn't get the job.
He's a weapon of a muso.
And James Hetfield said in an interview that, I think it was on that VH1 Behind the Music, that Les Claypool was quote unquote too good for the band, which Les Claypool says was complete bullshit. He said he would have looked like a complete freak in that band. And he's probably right. I couldn't think of a bigger mismatch.
I don't think we can mention South American bands without mentioning one of our own friend of the show and friend of the Dream Theater fan club as well, and many Dream Theater fan clubs around the world, Thiago Campos. And I'm sorry if I'm butchering your name, my friend, but your band Bad Salad, I think that's still your current band, and a lot of the stuff that you do with the covers on YouTube and so on and so forth is phenomenal. And there's a lot of the stuff that the musos that Thiago actually surrounds himself with are also fantastic musos as well. And it does seem that Dream Theater have a massive following down there in South America.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And a lot of other bands as well.
Yeah, the South American fans really get behind them. I mean, as evidence when Rush toured South America for the first time on the Vapor Trails tour in 2002. And they had really no idea what they were expecting when they got down there. They were playing to football stadiums, 60,000 people, 80,000 people. Have you seen the Rush in Rio DVD?
I have, yes.
Yeah, that is an amazing gig. I mean, those people just go nuts.
Absolutely.
You know, singing along to YYZ for fuck's sake, you know. You know, like that. It's just, you know, apologies for my singing. I know I have a shit singing voice. That's why I don't sing. I apologize also to everybody who's ever stood next to me at a concert and had to listen to me sing.
The other guy we should probably mention as well is the guy who auditioned for Dream Theater, talking about musicians who are auditioning for things. Is it Aquila Priester? Is that how you say his name?
Aquila Priester, yeah.
Yeah, phenomenal drummer.
He's amazing. And he also, I mean, and also as well, he writes lyrics, he writes melodies. He's a fantastic musician in general. The band that he was in at the time, he's not in that band anymore, was a band called Angra. Again, I apologize if I'm butchering that. Sorry, people of South America. They are really, really good. They're a phenomenal band. Obviously influenced by all the usual suspects in heavy metal, you know, Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, da-da-da, but also influenced by Sepultura quite significantly as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a really interesting thing to look at some of the music that has come out of Latin America as well. Latin America, classic prog rock, I suppose, has had quite a rich history with bands like Lagonia, Trem de Futuro, Sin Silencio, I think they're called, Anima Mundi, Quattro Sensorial.
The other one I was going to name check as well is Rodrigo y Gabriela. Have you heard those guys?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Amazing.
Obviously, they're from Brazil, I believe, but now they reside in Europe somewhere. But their song, I think that's the first one on their very first record, Tamakan. That is a fantastic song.
It is.
Have you seen any live videos of those two playing?
No, I never have.
Oh, go and have a look. And go and have a look at what Gabriela's doing to create that percussive sound on the guitar. I don't know how the fuck she does it, honestly. You know, Rodrigo is playing sort of with a pick and sort of quite, quote-unquote, normally, but she's doing some sort of percussive thing on the guitar. It is madness what the hell she's doing.
Mm. There's a lot of guitarists that are around that are doing that now, like the guy, Andy McKee, obviously our own Tommy Emmanuel as well, doing that sort of, you know, doing all the rhythm and then doing all the lead bits and all the percussion and everything like that on the guitar as well. There's one kid on YouTube, and I can't remember his name. I think he's Russian, and he does a cover of a whole bunch of different covers of different songs, but one that sticks in my mind is Careless Whisper. Mm. And
I've
you know
not
that,
heard of that.
Yeah. So there's, you know, the sax bit at the start of Careless Whisper, da 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 da, that gorgeous saxophone solo at the beginning that everybody loves. He does that on the guitar by hitting natural harmonics and then adjusting the tuning keys as he's doing all the other tapping and the other percussion bits and everything like that.
Yeah, it's, right. Okay.
It's insane. The kid's like 12.
Yeah, right.
It's like, I'm just going to give up. I don't understand where this talent comes from. But I think we can safely say that there is some absolutely fantastic stuff coming out of South America now. What are some bands do you reckon that our listeners should have a listen to?
I think if you should probably start to get some of the influences of these newer bands, I think you have to start with Sepultura.
Absolutely.
And then definitely have a listen to Bad Salad. Those guys are fantastic.
They are. They're really, really, really good.
It's not necessarily metal, but if you're interested in that sort of Latin jazz kind of thing, Rodrigo y Gabriela, their stuff. I wouldn't necessarily listen to the last record they did. I think it's called Area 51 or Area 52, mm-hmm. I think. That one, they actually got a full band in and kind of ruined everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because they got, the percussion and the horns and stuff. And redid a bunch of their songs, and I don't think it actually added anything. In fact, I think it detracted a lot.
Yeah.
And also, listen to some of their live albums. They've got a couple of live albums out there. They are really, really good.
Yeah, absolutely. There's some brilliant, brilliant guys out there. They're obviously just some. Mind Flow is another one that I can think of. I think from memory, the latest album they released is like 2011 or something like that, but really, really, really cool stuff. And they also created from memory, like an alternate reality game.
For the
release. Yeah. It's sort of like it's an ARG. So, follow your instinct. And it takes place in websites, emails, phone calls, media sources, and so on and so forth. Sort of like what Dream Theater are doing for the new album with the crazy, all the clues and you're following through and making phone calls and all that sort of stuff. I think they did a second one from memory as well. And they sort of got this whole, concept around the band where the disc from memory, the second one, the new website of the band when they released Destructive Device, the 2.0 version of the Follow Your Instinct game had the band become like a CIA kind of thing, like an intelligence organization. And the disc itself is portfolio evidence of this serial killer, new crimes the serial killer is creating that you're trying to find. And that's the start of the investigation, and you follow it on from there. It's really cool. They really take it sort of to the end, the nth degree with their stuff. So I highly, highly recommend those guys as well. They're really, really, really good.
All right.
So that's bringing us it's a long one today, and we do apologize to everyone.
We don't.
Listening to us prattle on about stuff that doesn't matter, but totally does.
God damn it, Dave.
Good segue, I suppose, into bands that do a lot of work. I had the opportunity and the pleasure to sit down with one of the members of Australia's very own Osaka Punch on Friday night. Now, you guys have probably heard about me prattle on about these guys for quite some time because it's simply because I absolutely love them. And if you haven't heard their biggest song, which is called How We Operate, do yourself a favor, pause the podcast and go and listen to it now. It is amazing. It's a fantastic, fantastic song. And a lot of the things that we're actually talking about, we've been talking about today, Dane actually brings up in this interview. So I'm going to slot this interview in here, and after the interview, we'll be back and we'll have a quick chat about it.
I'm currently sitting backstage after seeing the mighty Osaka Punch play in support of Mammal. Here in Sydney at the wonderful Manning Bar here on the University of Sydney campus. And I'm sitting down with Dane, the wonderful, wonderful drummer from Osaka Punch. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hello, good sir. I'm okay now. I'm post-gig, beer in hand, hiding away backstage. I love it. It's good. I'm well. Thank you. How are you?
I'm well. I'm well. Always a pleasure to see you guys play.
Thank you, sir.
This is, I think this is time number three for me, mm-hmm. seeing you guys first at Progfest and then with the Butterfly Effect. And you guys have been getting around quite a bit. Not as much in Sydney as I'd like, but, you know, I've seen you guys have been doing well.
Yeah, we, man, we're getting a lot of work at the moment. I think the band has done, it'd be close to 50 shows this year, and I've done about 70 shows this year, so it's like, yeah, we're getting around, we're cheap, we work hard, we don't complain much, openly.
Yes. As the old saying, I'd complain, but no one would listen.
Yeah, there is definitely that. I mean, Osaka Punch is that, and then looking deeper, I'm that in Osaka Punch, so I'm like the lowest priority in complaints. It's good. It's fucking really good, bro.
So I couldn't help but wonder whilst you guys were playing there tonight. You guys have incredible stage presence. Amazing, amazing stage. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that Jack is probably the best frontman in prog right now in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I'm including some of the mighty heavy hitters in that as well,
yep.
like Ian and Kenny from Carnival and
yep.
so on and so forth. Where does your on-stage, I suppose, persona come from? Is it from years of repressed strange things, going to Catholic schools or something, or is it...
it is for me.
We have something in common, only Christian school, but...
the Catholic school, Roman Catholic, the best of the Catholic regime. The truth of it is it doesn't matter if we're playing to 10 people or 1,000 people, we play for each other. You know, and that's there's a lot of I guess what's the word I'm looking for preconceived ideas when we come to making our film clips or like you know comedic antics that we have on stage. But as far as it goes in terms of the energy and just fucking throwing down comes down to I look over at Jack and he's losing his fucking shit, and then that makes fucking yes, and then I look over at Crispy, he's doing the same thing, you know, and we just kind of feed off each other's energy. So I guess like that's to me the only way that that kind of intensity comes off organically is if it is actually organic. You know, if it's preconceived, then it doesn't. It looks like it. You know, you see all these metalcore bands with their choreographed guitar spins and fucking stupid little crab dances and shit like that. Whereas with us, I don't know, we play funk, but I think we all wish we were playing death metal.
I think that's it's quite evident in the way you guys actually perform is that you don't play like a funk band or like a jazz band. You've obviously got quite a lot of elements of that within your sound.
Yeah.
But you do play like a prog band, like what we now would call prog rock, metal kind of stuff. Where did that blend come from? Because if you do listen to some of your earlier stuff, you are very, funky.
Psychedelic aspect to it.
Yeah. Your later stuff is definitely more along the lines of the heavier style of music. So yeah. Where did the change come from?
Well, we did have a lineup change, but a lot of it comes from, like, I guess, a pulling and pushing between members. Because, like, Jack listens to a lot of pop, a lot of R&B, a lot of funk-based stuff. I listen to a lot of, like, jazz, a lot of technical metal, a lot of neo-soul. You know, Crispy listens to a lot of underground metal, 90s rock. Brenton kind of listens to a wide range as well, and I guess kind of appeasing each other's tastes and expectations leads to us kind of doing this thing, this blend, which is like it's always a little bit poppy, it's always a little bit heavy. There's always an element of like kind of technical stimulus for muso wankers like me. You know, because it's generally, if I'm going to play it in four, it's got to be really fucking funky. Otherwise, I'm like, yeah, nine. You know, and then, like, you can even hear it. Like, they'll write a track and it's really basic, and then they'll, like, change one thing to a bar of five. It's like, there we go, Dane's sorted now. It's okay. I'll add in some double kicks, he'll get there. But no, a lot of it comes from generally trying to appease each other. And so that's the sound that's happened. We obviously had a lineup change where we had like a really jazzy guitarist in the band at the time, who inspired a lot of the psychedelic stuff. And then with the bass player and guitarist change, lack of a second guitarist, it just brought this more genty pop, chuggy chuggy, boo-doo bops. In there,
yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And you guys do have some pretty incredible hooks in some of your songs. I mean, pick the big one, How We Operate. Which is, I admit, it's my favourite one of your guys' stuff.
Yep.
But it's so catchy.
Mm.
And a lot of prog bands nowadays don't do that catchy stuff.
Nah.
It's just flat out prog, weird time signatures, jazz, like, basically nouveau jazz stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And they don't think about that radio play aspect. Is that something that you do tend to think of? Like, do you sit there, produce a song, and go, hang on a minute, how is the normal person going to think about this? Or
I think, look, in today's day and age, I mean, people don't even listen to bands anymore. They listen to songs, you know. They listen to playlists and not radio. But I guess the only audience that we kind of consider is not a new audience, but at the audience we do have. And so we generally start with something that's like a hook and it's catchy, and then we're thinking about our audience and going, well, I fucking know little Tommy Lambchop is not gonna fucking dig this shit because there's not one bastard boot up in there. And you know, and so what we do is we kind of start with a core idea. And then the core idea is what is the most important. And then all of the brainiac side to it, the intellectual side, that's something you just turn on. You know, okay, now we apply our thinking cap. Like, what are we doing here? Let's do this half time. Let's reharm these chords here. You know, let's change structures and things like that. That all comes later. So we start with a hook. And to be honest, we don't ever expect radio play or any form of like commercial access, so we're not really writing for that, you know. I mean, in comparison to prog bands or a lot of metal bands, yeah, we're really catchy, but in comparison to Kite String Tangle or, you know, bands like that, we're miles away, you know. So I guess in the demographic that we're kind of placed in musically, yeah, we're a pretty catchy band. It's not really a primary focus though, you know.
So what, aside from playing for yourselves, which you mentioned earlier, what is the primary focus for you guys? What's the end goal, I suppose? Is there an end goal?
It's an interesting thing because, like, when we were all growing up, you know, being in a band was a lucrative thing. You know, you go out on the road, you know, you see all the musos that you listen to when you're growing up, playing to 10,000 people a night and making all this money. And so the goal is still the same as when you started. I just want to play music. I want to play it a lot. I want to play it everywhere. And I want to make people happy doing that. And I want to be happy doing that. But what doesn't come into account is, you know, like I live on my own and I'm on tour right now. I just got to fucking, I'm in arrears with my rent because it's like I got to fucking pay for home, got to pay for being on the road, got to pay for actual living expenses, and all the while I'm self-employed doing music. And I guess the end goal has changed now. The end goal is to be able to survive and play music. You know, and that's the thing, like... The truth of it is, I don't want to grow up. I want to fucking play in a band until I can't anymore. And for whilst I'm doing that, it'd be nice if I could cover basic things, basic living expenses. I mean, we all do. We work hard to make sure we do. But it'd be nice to just be able to do it with peace of mind, you know, because it is, man, it's a different thing now. Like, you know, when we go back home, Chris isn't allowed days off because all of his annual leave goes on tours. So he will literally go home and work for 90 fucking days straight and then go on tour. It was like last, I think it was not the last one, where were Newcastle. We did Newcastle, Long Jetty, and... No, it was just those two shows. And Chris, he'd slept in and actually got a chance to sleep in for the first time in 2.5 months. Like, and I'm talking, like, quite literally, he had worked for, I think it was, like, 60 days or 70 days straight. You know, and then we're going, loading our gear, setting up, playing the shows, first band in, last band out, you know, fucking 40 airports every tour. So I guess the end goal is to be able to know that, you know, my friends being the guys in the band, that we're all well slept, well fed, and able to enjoy the simple things in life, like having partners and, you know, yeah, I guess the goal is to make it an actual job. But, you know, I love teaching and I love doing covers, gigs and session work, but fuck, it'd be awesome if the band could actually pay for our own rent and a small wage. That'd be a great goal, but because we're used to not doing that, that's irrelevant at the end of the day. We just want to fucking play, you know? If you're doing it for any other reason, if you're doing it for fame or to actually get rich or something like that, fuck off. You're in the wrong industry. It's such a small percentage that get that. And they normally dominate. Did he just step directly on that toiletries bag?
I think he stepped over it.
Excellent, because it's mine. This is good for the podcast. Fuck yeah, don't step on my toiletries bag, people. I'll get angry at you. In 9-8. But yeah, no man, it's an interesting question, and I'm sure like the other lads have got other ideas of what the end goal is, but you know, I guess at the moment we're just taking it a release at a time. So we're gonna go and record an album now. Long overdue.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
We just keep getting tour offers, man. Hey, like, and it's like, that's the thing. Everyone's like keen on an album, and it's like, we tend to go overboard with releases. I mean, the last release had like, what, 7 songs, but individual characters for each song, a back catalogue, stories, fucking, I think there was 4 film clips or something, yep. You know. That's a goddamn EP. It cost $11,000 to record the fucker before all of the, like, all of the cool shit afterwards, you know. So it's like this album, I think we've got like maybe about half of it written. How we operate is obviously going to be on that. We've recorded another single when we recorded that one too, which is very close to being released.
Awesome.
Yeah, and so I mean, you know, I can only imagine that this next album is going to cost a lot. You know, but that's the thing. Like we could record it like a fucking Nirvana album, like, you know, but we don't want to. We want it to be schmick. And you go to a label and you're like, hey, what do you reckon about this? They're like, we could market you to anybody, and that's not easy for us. So sorry. So we need to be smart with that. So that's like obvious reason why it takes us a while to release things.
Yeah.
Cash. And yeah, if someone offers us to go on a tour, we just say yes. We don't even check the bank. We just go, yeah, fuck yeah. And then argue for the next 3 months about how we're going to do it. And then just, oh, we're this, there, and we're doing it anyway.
So, something you said a little earlier, which was people don't listen to bands anymore, albums. They listen to singles and playlists.
I guess that's a blanket statement, and I don't mean to generalise, but I would imagine that the bulk populace that you play to when you're trying to make yourself commercially viable, generally they listen to songs, I guess. But was that,
Do you feel that's one of the reasons why music is not as lucrative as it used to be?
No. I think music is not as lucrative as it used to be because the wealth in the industry has been transferred from the creators to third parties. I mean, you know, people will ask, when's your album coming out? And it's like 0.00006 of a cent per stream. You know, I mean, we've got videos on fucking YouTube that have got CGU insurance ads at the start of it. No one fucking asked me if they could put that ad on my track, but of course they did. They asked YouTube, and YouTube said yes, of course you can. And when we upload our music to YouTube, the intellectual property becomes theirs as well, and therefore they get in front of that. And that's why I think it's not as lucrative, because this transformative stage in the industry has seen a lot of the values being shifted. And then what you get now is bands like myself, or people like myself in bands, that are, there's now more responsibility and more money and more output that gets put in, but with that comes more control.
Yeah.
And so I think that the lucrative nature of the business, it's still lucrative for a lot of people, just not the artists themselves, you know?
It's funny, we were talking about this on a couple of episodes back. We were talking about streaming services and Spotify and all the stuff to do with that. And that was one of the things that we brought up, was the lack of, I suppose, support for the artist from some streaming platforms. And, I mean, our podcast is now on Spotify as well.
Yeah.
Which I actually think is great, because it's out there to the masses and so on and so forth. That being said, interestingly, my girlfriend, I was talking to her the other day, and she said, I don't listen to it on that. So I listen to it on this other streaming things. Okay. But a lot of people do listen to their music that way, and I suppose it is.
I listen to my music that way.
There you go.
You know, like.
But I agree with you. I don't think it's, I mean, 0.0006 of a cent that goes to you per track play is just not enough.
Well, the way that system works is there's a budget that can be given to, there's a budget put aside for all of the artists.
Yeah, yeah.
And now when you've got artists on there like fucking Rihanna, you know, or Lord or someone like that, you'll have like this small band of top performing artists that absorb most of that budget.
Yep.
Like, you know, something shocking, like 3 or 4% of the budget each. And then you've got all of these low-lying mid-range bands that are on the 50 to 60,000 plays per month.
Yeah.
Then they absorb a good band of it. And then you've got the biggest band of artists there, with bands like us, you know, like 1,000 to 15,000 Spotify plays a month.
An hour, yeah.
And that is split up, you know, you might have like 15% of the budget left to go over 80,000 fucking artists.
Yeah.
You know, which is, I mean, these are all, I'm just pulling stats out of my ass. I'm not 100% sure, but I know that that's how the budget works.
Yeah.
And in which case, you know, you've got the CEOs of Spotify getting done. There was a $6 billion earnings the company made in 2017. And yet, we're here fucking eating shapes with fucking dips.
And they're not even shapes. I mean, they're shapes light.
I didn't do that. I didn't fucking do that. Those light shapes, those feel-good flavour shit, that's that guy over there with a tie-dye shirt who gets fucking angry breaking his own shit.
Just for the listeners, Crispy's just walked in and he's smirking at us over his shoulder because we're just taking a bit of the piss out of him at the moment for liking Crispy shirts and, you know, yep, there's the finger.
If only you could hear the middle finger. It was fucking brutal.
And I must say, you played an amazing show tonight, so as always.
Yeah, you did. That was good, man.
So, I suppose, what's next for Osaka Punch? You've got this, you mentioned now that you've got an album in the works.
Yep.
Any word on Progfest next year?
I mean, I guess we would be up for doing that again. We haven't heard anything regarding that. I think it'd be good for the band. I think it'd be good for the festival. The truth is, we're going to smash out a few more shows for the end of this year after this tour with a band called Omnific.
Yep.
And I think we've got a festival in Canberra next month. Yep. But then we're knuckling, we're locking down. We're saying no to stuff,
yep.
Which isn't very common for us. Mm-hmm. And just getting the fucking album done, man.
Awesome.
Like, yeah, it's got to happen.
Yeah.
It's got to happen. Like, I mean, we've been blessed with a fan base that is they're patient, man.
Mm-hmm.
They're patient. They respect the industry that we're in, and they know that we work really hard. And so we don't ever hear anyone being like, when's the fucking album coming? It's always like, we're going to work on an album. And they're like, yes.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good idea. I've listened to everything. I'm beginning to hate it.
I think it's somewhat like my reaction. It's like, yes, we just want new music out.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, particularly in the prog sphere, and I'm aware I've said that a couple of times throughout this interview.
Mm.
I think prog heads generally understand that stuff takes time. Yeah. For fuck's sake, we've been waiting, 12 years for a new Tool album? We can wait a little bit longer for an Osaka Punch album.
Yeah.
You know, and hopefully that comes out next year as well. But there are some, I don't know how. See, you're in a prog band, so I'm assuming you're quite into the prog scene.
Yeah. I've got another band that's a prog band as well, man. I've got two prog bands.
What's the other band you're in?
Some of Us.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't realise.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you've heard any of that stuff.
I haven't heard any of it, but I know the name.
Yeah, so Some of Us is kind of like an amalgamation of a few dudes in prog bands. So the singer from Kodiak Empire,
yep.
The bass player from Red in Tooth, and two other guitarists. It's one who won So You Think You Can Shred. The other one's been playing with me for years.
Yeah.
It's akin to kind of what we're doing here. It's just like, you know, it's technical, it's heavy, but it's beautiful at the same time. But yeah, man, like, yeah, that's it. I think a lot of people in the prog scene understand that. Because if you're into prog, you need more than the average listener to be, you know, stimulated.
Yeah.
And you have a finer appreciation for dense layers and acute information, you know, and in that, I think the prog listener, when they're waiting for something, all they can think of is that, oh, this is going to be good, like, they must be working really hard, and, you know, I mean, I know for me, I'm just thinking that the next Tool album is going to be the most beautifully jagged, angular, fucking lovely thing ever, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, it's the same kind of thing that you think of when Meshuggah take ages to release shit. But then, you know, you look at bands like Dillinger, who basically release an album every 2.5 years, and they write it when they're touring the current one, and then stop in this studio and record a track, and they just fucking pump it out.
Mm.
And then you look at bands like fucking Caligula's Horse. It makes you wonder, like, did you guys just write fucking 5 albums
mm-hmm.
before you and mentioned who you were, and yeah. then you were like, oh, we're this band, and just like fucking clockwork every 18 months or something, you just drop another one, like, because
yeah.
that, you know, and that's the thing, like. I think everyone's kind of got their own different arc on how they like to work.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, if you're talking about, like, Caligula's, they all write, they all put in the time, but Sam Vallon, the guitarist...
Yes, yes.
He will spearhead the direction, and therefore it's a clearer and easier thing to navigate and turn over, essentially. Mm. You know, whereas Osaka Punch is so fucking mixed, it's just like... One guy writes a whole track, the next dude comes in, rearranges the whole fucking thing, and the other guy's like, I hate it. The other guy's like, but I love it. And then it's just like, okay. There's like about 10 of those tracks just sitting there.
Yeah.
Prog heads. But yeah, man. Yeah, I think the prog audiences are genuinely more patient. And they also listen to a lot of music, so they can just wait for something whilst listening to something else.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Yeah. And Jim was actually on the podcast a couple of weeks ago after his show, the Seahorse show here in Sydney.
Did he talk about me?
You know what he did? He said that you've got the best legs that he's ever seen on a drummer.
He is so mean because I don't have the best legs. He knows that. And I was going to speak about Jim. I was going to speak about him. But now I'm not. I bet you Jim thinks that this podcast is about him. Fucking Jim. You're a beautiful man, Jimmy.
And I think that is the essence of a Osaka Punch right there. You know, just take the piss, have fun.
Yeah.
Do it with everything you do is somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but you're serious at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I was going to speak about Jim, and now I'm fucking not going to. No, you're right. There is that. There is almost a Freudian kind of aspect to what we do. So, like, you know, I guess... what's the point in taking yourself seriously?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know, we have conviction, we have respect for ourselves, and we are dignified individuals. Mm. But seriously, the world's a fucking rough place sometimes. If you can't, like, hang shit on yourself and laugh at it with yourself and others, like, just fuck off. Like, you know, I don't have the problem if you know you've got a conservative sense of humour, but I'm likely not going to hang out with you very much, you know. And I mean, like, that's the thing. I think at first Osaka was really confronting for people because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now, after everyone's watched us do it for 10 years, they're like, oh, no, they are actually those people.
Yeah.
You know, and so that makes it makes it easier being on the road. It makes it easier talking with people like yourself, because we don't have to put on anything. We don't have to put on this persona. It's just like people are like, oh, so yeah, dick and fart jokes. We're like, fuck yeah. Our bass player's got really tiny nipples. Check that out. Like, he does, actually. Wasn't he even lying?
No, I think it's I can't think of another question to end it more perfectly on this interview on, but there is one question I always ask people.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us something we don't know.
Tell us something we don't know about.
Up to you.
All right. This is a brutal thing that no one knows, and I'm giving this just to you, right? So, if I can fucking spot a zit that's fucking awesome, right? Sometimes I know that it'll be ready to go right then. Mm-hmm. But I think about how much fucking better it'll be at the end of the day, right? And I'll be like, fuck yeah, right? And then I'll go home and I'll make it fucking happen, boss, right? And if it's a good one, it's like got a hard bit in it. I'll put it on the mirror so I get a 3D fucking view. I can see from behind and in front, and then I'll be like, after it's out, it's kind of like sex. Like once you've orgasmed, and you're just like, ooh, it's sticky, and it's, I don't know, it's dark. Hold on, I'm gonna have a shower. But like the second I'll pop it, I'll get it out. I'm like, fuck yeah, that's a good one. And then I'm like, ooh, it's on my mirror. Like, and there you go. There's something that you definitely did not fucking know, bro.
that is it. I think Dane, thank you so much for joining us on the 9-8 podcast. If you do want to check these guys out, you can check them out playing with Mammal for the next little while. They are playing at obviously Manning Bar here this evening. It's probably going to be too hard to do that one.
Yep.
And then I think after this one, after this podcast comes out, there's the Zoo in Fortitude Valley there in Queensland.
Mm-hmm.
Outside Tribe Music and Arts Festival in Canoobia Park there in Queensland as well. And then one mentioned prior on the 13th of October, Chaos in the Capital 4, 2018 at the Basement in Belconnen, ACT. Dane, yep. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, man. No. I appreciate your time, dude. Thank you very much.
Really cool guy. And I was absolutely honoured to sit down with him after the show there, as he said, post show beer in hand. Hoggy, what did you have any thoughts about the interview at all?
It's really interesting that he was talking about how much that they just play the music for each other.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard a lot of bands say the same thing, that they sort mm-hmm. of write or play music for themselves, yeah. and then they just hope other people like it, as opposed to some other bands, not mentioning your names, of course, Kiss, who sort of play music as an entertainment thing for the fans, and less so about musical creation or, you know, art or anything like that.
Mm, absolutely. I think one of the things that was really interesting as well was hearing him say that they, not only do they play for themselves, but they feed off each other. And if you do get the opportunity to see these guys, you'll see their stage show. And their stage show is absolutely incredible. And it is because of exactly what Dane said in the interview, which was, you know, they look over and they see Jack, who's the front man of the band, going off his nut. And then he sort of goes, he fires up on that, and he looks over and there's Crispy the guitarist, and he's doing his hair, you know, waving and, you know, head banging and everything like that. And they're all just feeding off each other's energy on the stage. And it is absolutely incredible to watch, especially Dane, the drummer, who is one hell of a drummer. The other night on Friday night, they had a bit of a technical difficulty where they obviously had a ground loop arm or something in their in-ears. So they stopped after one of the songs. And Jack said, we're just trying to find a gremlin who's clearly talking to us in our ears. And he says, kill all the people. And then and he makes all these jokes, right? But as they're doing that, the bass player, Reggie and Dane, just started having a little bit of a jam, like, you know, sort of intermission music kind of thing. And I tell you, this Dane is doing this shit with a hi-hat with one hand, and I ain't got no idea how the fuck he did that. I'm watching it going, what the fuck? And I'm standing next to a mate of mine who's in a band from Sydney called Stormbird, a JC, who's the bass player, and he just turned to me and went, dude, the fuck? And it's like, yeah, man, this guy is an absolute weapon, and he is. He's incredible, incredible drummer. And all the guys in the band are amazing musos, and they take on so many different influences. And I think that was one of the really critical things for me about the interview, was hearing him say, you know, basically we take on so many different influences. We've all got such a wide array of influences that sort of boils down to what we do, which is this weird, I think he used the word pop gent or gent pop.
Yeah, gent pop.
Which is a great way to describe what they do. It's great.
It's a truly progressive ideal of sort of mixing the different styles, you know. Mm-hmm. One of the guys is into like jazz and stuff, and one of the other guys is a big heavy metal guy and all that. Mm-hmm. So they sort of meld all that together.
Mm, absolutely. What about anything else really strike you from the interview?
The other thing that he said, that he said that people don't listen to bands anymore, they listen to playlists.
Uh-huh.
I guess you and I are the outliers on that one, because I listen almost exclusively to entire albums. Very rarely do I listen to playlists.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I know I'm the odd one out on that one.
Mm. I mean, I listen to albums mostly as well. I will listen to specific songs on albums, particularly if it's a shit album, but there's like two or three absolutely banging tracks on it. The Astonishing.
we should have like a bell that goes off every time we take the piss out of that record.
A counter, Astonishing counter. We'll put it in the show notes. But I think he is right. And it is really unfortunate. And you do see a lot of bands now, whereas once upon a time, bands would release an album and then they would release a single from the album and they would tour the album and so on and so forth. Nowadays, a lot of bands start with singles and they do everything with the single. They do the song and then they release it and they do the film clip and they do the tour around the single and they do their other songs around the single as well. And then they do an EP off the back of that and da-da-da-da-da. And it's a smart way to go, don't get me wrong, but I think it says a little bit about the attention span of a lot of people today in the industry, unfortunately, or people who are musicians or people who listen to music these days.
Yeah, I know Weird Al Yankovic has said that he basically doesn't want to be doing albums anymore, because the way that the market is, and specifically the way that he writes music, it's sort of parodies and stuff, it's very easy for him to just do a single and put it out as a parody of a thing, rather than having three or four, you know, waiting to put an album together.
That's right.
It's sort of being less relevant because he's parodying some song that was written 2 years ago.
That's right.
So, but the thing I was going to say about what Dane was saying, I don't think you can necessarily generalize how people listen to music. I think it's so sort of disparate and... Mm. You know,
and he
there
did
are
make
people
that
point. Do listen to. Yeah, he made that point that, you know, people listen to playlists. You've got old fogies like us who only listen to albums. Then you've got people like that colleague you were talking about who only listens to top 40 and just sort of whatever's just, you know, the sort of bullshit that's on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
I think the way that people listen to music these days is so disconnected. Like, there's just so much disconnection from. It's not the one way that people used to listen. You know, people would buy the 45 that came out in the record store or whatever, or hear
That's
a song
right.
on the radio.
That's right.
It's becoming so, you know, so much more disconnected.
And it's a bit of a shame. I think it's actually a very big shame. I found it interesting as well that he actually mentioned that 0.0006 of a cent per stream figure that we were talking about a month ago now, I think, on our episode of Spotify and streaming services.
Yeah.
You know, and he that explanation that he gave of the breakup of how, you know, there's some big artists who basically take a lot of the cream off the top, and then the rest of the artists are basically left fighting for, you know, the scraps
pennies basically.
Which is just disgusting in my opinion.
It is.
It's not even pennies, it's you know, less than pennies.
It's very much sort of meet the new boss, just like the old boss sort of thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, 100%. How it was before is it was a couple of big artists that used to make all the money and everybody else got the shaft.
That's right.
You know, and it's the same now on Spotify, where you've got the big, you know, the Rihannas and the Beyoncés and the Ed Sheerans of this world who are making it hand over fist, theoretically, on those services. And then you've got this sort of musical middle class and that are sort of just getting screwed.
That's right.
I think they call it the superstar effect.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But no, cool. Definitely a cool interview. And we are going to be doing some more interviews with some other bands in the future. So stay tuned for those. I'm not going to drop any names here, but we do have a couple lined up for the interview and for the podcast in the near future. So definitely stay tuned for that. Great interview with the guys from Osaka Punch. With Dane, I should say, from Osaka Punch. We look forward to hearing more from them. And if you do want to catch these guys, I know I said it in the actual interview itself, but I'll just give them a slight plug here because they were so awesome to deal with, and it was great to catch up with them. Chaos in the Capital is probably your next best chance to catch these guys. Which is going to be in, the capital of Australia, Canberra, on the 12th or the 13th of October, which is definitely going to be awesome. If you are going down to that, feel free to come and say hello. I will be there with bells on. Definitely come down and check those guys out with some other great bands that are going to be playing on the evening as well. So Hoggy, I think this brings us to some album recommendations and some album recommendations that we did last week and some new ones.
Yes. So I gave you the album to listen to from the law offices of Levin, Miniman and Rudess. Mm-hmm. And for those listeners who are wanting to play along at home with our album recommendations and listening to these records, I do heartily apologise. This is the second time in a row I have picked an album that cannot be streamed. So you had to buy this one on iTunes.
Yes.
Which is a scummy bastard of a place to buy music from, but, you know, whatever.
It really is, which is, a bit irritating.
Even nerds complain about iTunes, Dave. It's fine. We could just freely dump on iTunes as much as we like. Everybody hates it. It's fucking shit, and I'm pretty sure Apple have given up on it. They're just like, people stream music these days. Fuck it. iTunes can just die in a hole. And it's now just a place to put podcasts.
Well, that's basically all it is, let's be honest. And even that's being taken over by Spotify and so on, which we are now on. Yay!
Yay!
We can get 0.006 of a stream of a cent per stream. Yay!
I don't think that's how it works with podcasts, actually. I don't think you get anything.
probably not. So the actual album itself was absolutely incredible. I bought it from iTunes, but I decided to jump online and have a look for some of the reviews as well, just to sort of prepare myself, because I know, having heard the first one, it's a head fuck. not that it's bad or anything like that. It's just there's so much going on, and I think there's a perfect description for this album on Amazon Music. And this was written by The Musical Melting Pot. And the quote is, "If it sounds like too much, it's probably a sign that you need to hear faster." And
oh, goodness.
That's all I can tell you about it. Songs
there are a lot
on
of
it,
notes on this record. There are a lot of notes.
Oh, mate, it's unbelievable. Obviously, the opening track, Back to the Machine, is, well, yep. But song the stuff that's on there, like Marseille, When the Gavel Falls, The Verdict, Magistrate, etc. It's just unbelievable. Unbelievable.
You know what the phenomenal thing about this record is?
What?
I can pretty well guarantee you that not a single note of it was written with all three members in one room.
No, absolutely not.
This record, well, the first one was done sort of through the mail, as these things tend to be, where somebody starts off. I think it started off with Marco. He started off with some, like, guitar tracks and drums, and then he sent it to Jordan, and then Tony got involved and all that. And I'm pretty sure the second record is written exactly the same way.
They're just... Yeah, I can't. I just do yourselves a favor. Go out, buy it, and listen to it. That's all I can tell you.
I will put a link in the show notes if you wish to have the physical product. Lazy Bones Records. Lazy Bones Records. They are the ones who have this record. Put a link in the show notes to if you want to have the physical CD. Yep. You can buy it from them. Other than that, unfortunately, you're gonna have to buy it on iTunes.
Yeah. Or Amazon Music or anywhere you can actually purchase the album itself. So definitely worth, at least worth one listen. Just incredible. Absolutely incredible. However, mine was a little bit easier to access. It was the Lydian Collective, which I gave you. Hoggy, what'd you think?
I really liked it. This was definitely a sort of a different shift from some of the other stuff that you've recommended for me, where it's a lot of heavier and a lot of metal and all that sort of stuff. This was sort of a bit more of a, and I mean this in the nicest possible way, sort of an easy listening sort of thing.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, the sort of thing we're recording as right now on a Sunday morning, and it was the sort of record that I really like to have around on a Sunday morning.
Absolutely. It's cooking music for me.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Sort of while you're baking or making pizza or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Or if I'm cooking, you know, scrambled eggs on a Sunday morning, as you mentioned, I put this sort of stuff on, and it just lightens the mood. It's just nice, you know.
Yeah, it's just a nice album to have. If I had to pick a particular track, I would pick the third one, Cascades. I really like that one. That was a really nice one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. It was just a fun album to listen to. So yeah, there you go. So what have you got for me this week, Hoggy?
So I'm going to reach back into the archives of my music and pick an album by Rick Wakeman.
Okay.
So this one, I mean, if you had to pick what I think a lot of people think of when they think of prog rock, this is probably this one and probably Yes's Tales of Topographic Oceans are the two records they're probably going to think of. Mm-hmm. So this one is called The Myths and Legends of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table.
Ooh, I like the name.
It is. Have a listen to it.
All right, I will do, and I will report back dutifully. As we tend to do. Definitely. It's available on Spotify, this one, right? I haven't got to go to
Yes, iTunes. Yes, this one is actually available on Spotify. I haven't stuffed you up this time.
All right, good.
So this album, the original album was released in 1975, but there is a re-record that was done 2 years ago with additional parts previously removed from the original score. Because, of course, in 1975 it was vinyl and you can only fit so much on one vinyl. That is my record for you. The Myths and Legends of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table from 1975.
Fantastic.
What have you got for me?
So, I stumbled upon these guys on all Spotify, just doing like a, you know, new albums stuff. Have you heard of the Night Flight Orchestra?
No.
All right. So my album for you for this week is called Amber Galactic by the Night Flight Orchestra. And yes, you can find them on Spotify.
Excellent.
Go and have a listen to that. It's not exactly prog rock, but it's a hell of a lot of fun.
All right. So there we are. I think that just about covers it for this week.
I agree with you. I think that just about wraps it up. Next week, we don't really have a great deal on. I'll be really honest. Because it doesn't look like there's a whole bunch of news that's going to be coming out in the next little while. So we can't tell you what we're going to be talking about next time, but that just means that you should definitely tune in because you don't know what we're going to be talking about, Well, I suppose the title of the episode might give it away a little bit.
The one thing that we will be talking about next week, though, the new Riverside record will be out by the time we record next. So Absolutely. We will both listen to that and we will definitely be giving our tuppence worth on that record.
Perfect. And of course, all the latest news and happenings in the world of prog over the next 2 weeks, we will be reporting it to you so you don't have to go out and listen to it yourself. Hopefully we will also be able to finally bring you another interview that I did recently with the boys from Opus of the Machine. We haven't posted yet because we did have a few audio difficulties with the recording, unfortunately. But now that's all cleaned up and I've managed to salvage the audio, which is great. So we will be bringing that interview to you next time. So as always, thanks very much for tuning in. My name is David Ellis.
And my name is Alex Holt. We will see you all next fortnight.
See you then.
Adios.